everyone, and thank you for joining us today for this GRF CPAs and Advisors webinar. The title of the webinar today is Demystifying the most Pressing Sustainability and Regulatory Issues Facing Facility Managers Today. Are you ready for the significant changes on the horizon? And with me today is Erin Riley. Erin, I am delighted that you've joined us today to speak about some of the significant issues pertaining to the title of this webinar. I will now hand it over to you so you can give a quick introduction to yourself. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Omid. So my name is Erin Riley. I am a LEED accredited sustainability professional working as a consultant specializing in life cycle emissions, carbon accounting, and diversionary programs. I've had the opportunity to work with companies large and small, public and private, nonprofit, for profit, and colleges and universities. And it's really kind of exposed me to a lot of different need sets and ways to kind of support a variety of organizations. And so I'm really excited to have the time with you guys today. So thanks so much, Omid.
Thanks, Erin. I'll give a quick introduction to myself. I'm Omid Mohebi, CPA. I've been with GRF CPAs and Advisors since 2011. I'm a manager at the firm specializing in audits of nonprofit organizations. I also hold the AICPA certification on the fundamentals of ESG, and I'm part of the team leading the firm's external ESG consulting practice. So welcome again, and thank you again, Erin, for joining us. Now, to start with, Erin, can you please tell us about some of the main regulations that are in place today and some that are also on the horizon, why these regulations are important, and perhaps we can start with regulations that are sort of closer to home?
Yeah, sure. That's a great place to start. So in our sort of local DMV operating area, the regulations that are going to be most prevalent and pertinent for today's conversation really center around diversionary efforts and also net zero operations. And those can most be readily seen in jurisdictions like Montgomery County in Maryland or the District of Columbia, all who have some pretty aggressive targets that will become implemented between 2032 and 2036, which can seem far away, but in reality, in order to hit some of these very aggressive targets, we really do need to get moving today.
You're absolutely right, Erin. Some of these standards and these regulations seem like they're still a long way off, but they'll be here before you know it. And organizations need to start planning now, right? So what can they do right now? You talked about diversion, you talked about net zero. Perhaps you can give our attendees, some of whom may not be as fully versed with some of this terminology, give us a little bit more about sort of, okay, what does diversion mean? What does net zero mean? Give us some examples in the office regarding things like composting and recycling and so on. And, you know, we have spoken before about how recycling batches can be contaminated. So perhaps with net zero and diversion, you can give us a few good examples so people can get a better idea.
Yeah, sure. So when I say diversionary efforts, I'm really talking about waste diversion. So when we start thinking about waste diversion, we think about it in the framework as 100% of our waste that is associated with the operation of our business going to the landfill. Obviously, that's not what we want. So we want to divert some of that waste from the landfill to other streams. And those two primary streams are your recycling stream and your composting stream. And so the most valuable and easiest and highest kind of benefit way that you can get to a high diversion number is through composting. And so that's where we really want people to start refining and evolving their existing programs to include composting efforts. And these are anything, essentially your food waste, kind of if you think about if it grows, it goes. And so food waste and organic material, when it goes into the landfill cycle, it produces a high amount of methane as it breaks down. And methane is one of those greenhouse gases that we really want to try and limit. And so if we can send our organic waste to the compost stream instead of the landfill stream, we can cut down on a tremendous amount of the methane that is associated with our waste. And it also costs a lot less to send it to the composting stream. So that's good too. And then for recycling, we're really thinking about how we can take our existing recycling programs and optimize and maximize them. So how can we take a current recycling diversion rate of, say, 30 or 40% and increase that to 60% or 65% with the rest of our stream going to composting and then just a very small amount going to your landfill? So that's what I talk about when I talk about diversion. Now, when I talk about net zero, that can be a part of diversion, and it can also refer to your overall building operations. So some local jurisdictions have already passed legislation that require us to get to a net zero diversion rate, meaning you are diverting 100% of your waste stream. So it's all going somewhere,
Right.
and it's not going to the landfill. Or we could be talking about net zero operations, which means in effect, you are not taking anything that you are not offsetting to
Right.
run the operations of your business. And that is an extremely difficult thing to achieve, and it's going to require a huge amount of consensus and planning from a lot of different entities within your organization and outside of your organization.
Fantastic. And given your experience of working for organizations, what are the challenges that employers and facilities managers face in educating employees and getting the employees to do these things? You know, we all know that you can put receptacles in certain parts of the office, say that, you know, the composting. What are some of the challenges that you've come across, and what are some of the effective methods that you've seen employers, office managers, facility managers using in order to sort of expedite and inform, expedite the process and inform and educate the employees about the new ways of doing things?
That's a great question. So facility managers have a pretty steep hill to kind of climb. And that's really because humans are, we are creatures of habit. And so
Yes.
we have all been throwing things away in a particular pattern for most of our lives. And for some of us, that's a longer period of time than others. But we've all gotten into some pretty bad habits. And it takes time and consistent reinforcement in order to shift those human behaviors. And so facility managers really need to involve a variety of different communication and education methods to reach the most amount of people in the shortest amount of time
Right.
possible. I would say communicate often and in a variety of different ways. So from verbal to written communication that's coming out in sort of digital blasts to posted communication that visually reminds us as
Yes.
we are nearing a receptacle where things are supposed to be going. And then, little rhymes. I mean, it might sound silly, but it helps. If you're thinking about implementing a system and you're trying to get people to think about putting their food waste in a separate place from the container that their food is on, you could do something like, scrape plate, and it you just something
Right.
easy, a moniker that people
Something
can sort of,
fun. Something fun that
yes.
people remember, because at the beginning they might think, oh, come on, give me a break. You know, I'm busy, I have work to do, I don't have time to spend 5 minutes figuring out which item goes into which receptacle. But
Yeah.
first of all, make it fun, make it informative. Also over time, as you said, by reinforcing that behavior, it just becomes second nature, right? You kind of know, oh, this is food, this goes into this one, this is plastic, it goes to this one, and so forth.
And find ways, I would say, to recognize the right behavior. So and to reward people, by communicating about what their change in pattern is doing. What are you seeing as a change, as a reward for that change of behavior? So do we see the diversion numbers going up? What does that mean? What could that equate to? How many trees have we saved? You know, how many
Right.
cars have we fueled? Translate that information and those behavior pattern shifts into something that people can feel good about. We all
Something
want to feel
tangible.
good.
I love that. Yeah, I love that idea. I actually the tell people not, okay, you're doing this, we're doing it, but what is the result of this? You know, fine, you know, we won't be able to identify the trees that you save, but these are the number of trees you save. This is the other benefits that you contributed to the environment. I love that. And people can see that there are some real tangible benefits from just taking a minute or two over a few weeks to figure out what goes where. And after a few weeks, they can do it in a matter of seconds.
Exactly. After a few weeks, you don't think about it anymore, and you have established a new behavior pattern.
Thanks for that, Erin. You talked some of the regulations closer to home. Maybe you can also just touch on for some of our attendees who are not in the DC, Washington, DC, DMV area, they may be across the United States. Tell us some of the other regulations, both in California, for example. I know there's the California Climate Related Financial Risk Act, CFRA. Then we're also looking at the Climate Corporate Data Accountability Act, CCDAA. And I know there's other regulations in the EU and SEC as well. Maybe you can give us a sort of a synopsis of those, please.
Yeah, sure. So this is where it really begins to get into how we are going to revolutionize the way that we are thinking about sustainability. So these next set of regulations that we're going to talk about are a big shift for all of us in how we are thinking about the impact of the materials we're using and the things we are consuming. And so I want to draw your attention first to the two bills that you mentioned out of California.
Yes.
And those passed in 2023. So they passed last year and they are already law. That's SB 253 and SB 261. Now, these two bills are really complementary to one another. The first, SB 253, is really focusing on the emissions accountability for what you are using. And then SB 261 is really focusing on the climate-related financial risk of your operation. Both of these bills have a threshold set for who it applies to. And right now, it's a pretty high threshold. So we're talking about $1 billion of revenue for SB 253, and we're talking about $500 million of revenue for SB 261. And so it certainly isn't going to apply to everybody, but there are quite a number of companies that are active in our local area who have that number of revenue today in California.
Yes.
And so they are going to be required to participate in this disclosure.
And as we know with other regulations, whether it's in the environmental sector or otherwise, you know, they start off with these big organizations, but over time, it's just a matter of time before, first of all, other states pick up on it. So they, you know, California is known for being very, you know, very giving particular attention to some of these issues, but it's only a matter of time before that sort of spreads to other states across the United States. And it's also a matter of time before those thresholds start coming down, right? They're going to say, okay, the next band is like, we're going to start requiring smaller firms to do this. And I know that some firms may not be required to, because of their size, to conform to some of these standards, but they may want to do it just as a matter of best practice over time anyway.
Yes, because you're absolutely right. They're starting big, but they don't stay there. And if you think about the fact that this legislation just passed in 2023, and they are already going to be asking companies to produce data for the fiscal year 24 and 25, that is not a lot of time to get that compliance in order and to be able to do
Right.
the diligence required to get you there. And so it's very likely that if there was that short of an interval between legislation passed and implementation period beginning for these large-scale companies, the same will follow suit, if not more aggressively, for the smaller entities. And so it
Right.
behooves everybody to start thinking about these things right now. And you're right, other states are following suit. New York put forward a couple of bills through their legislature that did not make it all the way to the governor's signing desk, but it's only a matter of time before that happens.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Erin, for that first sort of subject area that we discussed. Let's move on to life cycle and emissions. Again, everyone knows what emissions are, but our attendees may not know exactly what we mean by life cycle. Perhaps you can expand on that. And also, we talked about the regulations, both present regulations and others in the pipeline. What can organizations actually do to meet these regulations, both current regulations and those in the pipeline? And how can they make sure they're compliant today and they continue to be compliant as the new regulations kick in over the foreseeable future?
So it can get really confusing pretty quickly when you start talking about scope one, two, and three emissions. Most of us have probably heard that terminology, but when you start to try to wrap your brain around what does that actually mean for me as a facility manager or as a leader within an organization, it can get muddy fast. And so it's helpful to try to think about scope one, two, and three in the most simplest of ways possible. And so scope one emissions are things that you are directly burning. And so you're thinking about if you have a company car and you're putting gas in that company car, the emissions associated with that company car are going to be in your scope one bucket. You directly control and are responsible for the generation of that emission line. Scope two is going to be things like if you are a leased occupant within a larger building, the electricity that you use to power your computers, to have this conversation we're having right now, to print out, your next report. That electricity is going to go into your scope two bucket. It is something that you can directly control the consumption of, but you are not the primary driver of that whole electrical bill.
Right.
Scope three is everything else. So everything else that is not directly energy related, but is associated with the running and operation of your business. So think about your the fuel it takes your UPS driver to deliver your packages. That's going to be in your scope three bucket. The emissions associated with the cleaning of your offices within your lease space, that's going to be in your scope three bucket. So it's all those other emissions that are associated with your supply chain, essentially.
Right. And would it be correct to say, given these scopes, that scope threes would be much more difficult for organizations to measure? And perhaps to start with, they should focus on scopes one and two, because those would be the data available for that would be more readily available.
Absolutely. If you are just beginning this journey, start with what's easiest.
Right.
Start with what you can start measuring today that you've got reliable data on, that you know is material to your organization, and that you can begin to collect the data. That is where the primary driver of the regulatory environment is. When we think about things like the SEC, their ruling, which has been stayed as it goes through the court process. They decided they weren't going to require the tracking and reporting of those scope three emissions, but they did very much want to see the one and the two. And so start there, but also start having the conversations with your vendor and supply chain and start looking at your current purchasing habits to reduce the amount of work you're going to have to do in the future, because Scope 3 is really where the majority of our emissions and the majority of our ability to drive the change needed is going to lie. So if you can tackle those in any measurable way, there's going to be a lot of value in that work.
Thanks for that. That was a very nice explanation of the difference between the three scopes. I know a lot of our attendees will be hearing those sort of that terminology throughout the sort of the ESG and sustainability sphere, and they're wondering, what does that mean? You talked about materiality. Tell us a little bit more, please, on sort of the what how materiality fits into what we're talking about here, how it would differ for different organizations, and whether it's an exact science to it or whether it's subjective. Perhaps you can expand a little bit more on that. Thank you.
That's the that's the frustrating thing in all of this is none of it is exact. None of it is really a science. It is all gray area, which is frustrating, but it's also a great opportunity. So within your scope one and two buckets, those are really cut and dry. Those are easy to determine whether they're not, whether they're material or not. So you think about the amount you're spending on operating your space. That is a material spend. And so you're going to want to track it and you're going to want to report on it. You may also be purchasing, let's say, 350 other products and materials. Some of those you may spend a few hundred dollars on in a year. Some of them you may spend a few hundred thousand dollars on in a year. So if you're going to approach materiality and you're looking at it from a cost framework, you're going to want to look at those largest spend buckets. Those are going to be what's most material to your organization. If you're a company who would prefer to look at materiality through a volume lens, you could say, okay, what am I purchasing the most of? It might not be the most expensive items, but I sure am using a lot of them. So I should really be tracking and measuring that data. And so you, as a facility operator or as a leader within an organization, gets to control what you determine to be material in scope three, and therefore what you are reporting on. So the regulators have not gone so far into the weeds as to try and tell a business owner what's important. I don't think they ever should, and thankfully they didn't. And so you get to decide what's important and what you should measure.
So it sounds like for materiality, there needs to be, as long as it's a reasonable, there's a reasonable methodology that can be documented. But it's what also sounds like it has to be consistently applied. So you decide what is material for your organization or the different criteria that we mentioned. But you need to also, it's good practice to document it. So, you know, people have it in written form. How do we decide what's material and what's not material? And also to apply it consistently over time so that materiality doesn't keep changing significantly over time. Of course, it may change depending on the operation of the business changing over time. But other than that, there really should not be a huge amount of fluctuation.
Correct. Unless you have major operational changes into the way you are operating your business or producing the materials you're producing, the materiality should stay rather consistent. But it is something that you want to revisit, I would suggest, at least on an annual basis. So generally, you know, leadership is going to sit down on an annual basis to go through, you know, risk profiles and budgeting purposes. This should be something that you review annually. Okay, does this still apply? Do we think that these are still the things that we should be reporting and recording? Or should we introduce some new subjects into that bucket? It's not something that will stay constant forever, but it should stay fairly consistent over an annual period.
And then revisit it annually or so to see what has changed significantly.
Yes, and then you would just disclose in your written documentation the revisionary methodology that you went through and why you incorporated the changes, and you do have the ability and the flexibility to do so.
Great. Thanks, Erin. Could you tell us a little bit more about life cycle? You hear this terminology a lot, in sustainability policies. You hear it a lot in terms of office spaces and so on, in terms of what do we mean when we talk about emissions and life? What do we specifically mean by the term life cycle? Perhaps you can give us a
Yes.
few examples. Thank you.
This is probably going to be the most transformative piece of what we're going to talk about today. And that is life cycle analysis. So up until this point, we've really been looking at what we deem to be sustainable or green or environmentally preferred through a very narrow lens. And we are now going to be broadening that lens to think about the full life cycle impact of anything we're using. So essentially the cradle to the grave. So all the raw materials it takes and all of the energy it takes to produce it through the actual manufacturing of the product, the shipping of the product, and then the use of the product. And then the life cycle ends. So how does it degrade? What is the impact of that material as it begins to break apart? What sort of greenhouse gases does it release? That is all going to be considered. Ooh,
Taken
that
into
was
consideration when making choices.
exactly. It will all be taken into consideration as we then start to modify and change some of the earlier decisions that we've made on what potentially could be the best choice or the most environmentally preferred product. And you can think about something like microfiber cloths in the cleaning industry. For the past, say, 15 years or so, there's been such a strong push to remove paper towels from being the primary method that you're using to dispense the cleaning activities, and shifted everybody towards a microfiber towel because they're reusable. They can be washed and reused 250, 500, 1,000 times, depending on the durability of that cloth. But now, we're starting to take into account the fact that those microfiber cloths release microplastics every single time you wash them. And those microplastics go into our water streams and into the fish we eat and is present in every single one of us. And so, is that really the best product? It takes very high heat and releases a large amount of greenhouse gases as you are generating that microfiber cloth. And so it actually might be better to use a rapidly renewable plant fiber instead. And so as we start to think about these products and materials differently, we may come to different conclusions on what we should be using. And those life cycle changes will have an impact on what we're purchasing and why.
So even an office, an employer or a facilities manager who's they want to buy new furniture to for new office furniture for the whole office. So it's not about, oh, let's just, it's a desk is a desk or a chair is a chair. So, okay, what is it made of? Where is it made? What is it made of? How much energy is being used to manufacture this product? What about transportation to a distributor, in the United States? And where is a distributor? And, how are you going to clean this? How much cleaning product do we need to use? When the day comes when we want to dispose of this, how do we dispose of it? How much energy is going to be used in the waste disposal facility and so on? So you're looking at, as you said, from the beginning of the manufacturing process all the way to the disposal.
You've got it exactly right. And so little things that perhaps you didn't think about before as you were evaluating your purchasing decisions become really pertinent and relevant. So where is that distributor located? Like you mentioned, is it 2,000, miles away, or is it 50 miles away? Was that product manufactured in South America, or was it manufactured in Asia? Those same products will have a very different profile attached to them depending on where they were manufactured and how the journey it took to reach you.
Fantastic. Thank you, Erin. We're going to move on to sort of the final talking point of our fireside chat today. Now, we've talked about the regulations, we've talked about how businesses can enforce, make sure that they remain compliant with those regulations. Let's talk about why businesses should do this from a business point of view. You know, a lot of businesses will say, yes, we want to do the minimum we can to stay compliant with the regulations, whether they're the current regulations you mentioned, whether they're the ones that are on the horizon. But sometimes business just want to know, does this also make business sense for us? How will it affect our bottom line? Perhaps you can talk about some of the factors or some of the ramifications from a business point of view, and we can then expand on a few of them.
Yeah, sure. It has to make sense to do these things, right? It can't just be because we have to do them or it's the right thing to do. It also, whether or not it makes sense, it determines a lot of the timing on when you start or really get going. And so there are some direct and obvious financial implications, the fines that are associated with non-compliance to the regulatory timeframes that have been set. But there is also financial costs associated with things like optimizing your purchasing. And so, as we start to enter this new regulatory environment, the amount of time and therefore the cost of time you are using to document all of these things is going to grow exponentially. Most companies do not have the budget to have somebody internally whose sole job is to think about these things. And
Yes.
so the sooner you can start, the better your chance is to avoid those direct fines, because these things take a lot of time, and effort and intention to accomplish. And so chipping away at that right now is going to be very helpful. Getting your vendor partners on board and making them aware that these regulatory environments exist at all is going to be highly impactful to your ability to meet the deadlines. Because, as you said earlier, none of this we can really do on our own. We are all going to have to work with each other and rely upon the data of our vendor and supply partners in order to meet these requirements. And so getting them to get their data in place so that they don't hold you back is a great reason to get this going now. There's also some things that have mid to long-term financial benefits when you think about the impact to your insurance premiums. So I think there's two insurance premium buckets where these activities and these initiatives can make a difference, not immediately, but as you allow the time for them to produce the benefit. Are with your health insurance premiums and then your workers' comp premiums.
Right.
Health insurance is kind of easy. You think about some of these things as employee wellness programs. So as you are starting to introduce things like centralized trash initiatives and you're encouraging people to no longer just discard of their waste at their desk side container, but get up from their desk,
Right.
move a few feet.
Not just turn the swivel chair 180 degrees, 90 degrees to reach for the trash.
Exactly. Like actually physically get up and move
Right.
your body. One of the worst things as humans we could do for our ourselves is to just sit in one place all day, or to do the same rote behavior patterns all day long. So the more that we can change that and get ourselves moving, even if it's just in little small bites, it has a direct impact on things like our cardiovascular health, and also our mental well-being. And those things you really do see in the costs associated with the delivery of healthcare for your employees, but also on the back end, on things like your experience modification rating, when your workers' comp premiums are being associated. So if you can lower, that EMR rating by being a less risky organization, then your cost profile is going to be lower. And that is going to have a direct financial impact on your ability to operate in the most efficient way possible. And then outside of the financial lane, oh, actually, one more financial benefit. I think
Sure.
I mentioned it earlier, but in the diversionary efforts, sending things to the landfill is the most expensive hauling method. It costs less
Yes.
money to send that same material in a different truck to the compost stream or to the
Right.
recycling stream. And so if you can divert what you're sending to the landfill, you can reduce the cost of your hauling, which does have an operating income benefit. And then outside of the financial benefits, there are employee wellness and company culture soft benefits that you can
Yes.
achieve from this.
Happier employees and healthier employees. Healthier employees, if you get up from your desk, walk over to the kitchen or wherever these containers are for the composting, for the recycling. If you do that even 5 times a day, that adds up, right? On a daily basis, you're doing a significantly more exercise than you would otherwise. And if you add, okay, we're not in the office every day. Most people are now hybrid, but even if you come to the office on a hybrid basis, that still adds up. So there's physical well-being that's good for your health, but also you're likely, we used to talk about water fountain conversations or
Exactly
whatever.
what I was thinking
You
about.
know,
Yep,
these
the
can
water
be,
cooler.
we can have compost container conversations, and I have to tell you that the first time you see the composting container, it seems a little unusual. You're like, oh, well, first of all, you don't have to look inside, but it's just food. But after a few days, it's just like, so what? What's the big deal? This is just
It's just
people's,
part of the fabric of your
they just
office.
scraped off their plate. And but those are some really great soft benefits that you mentioned. You talked about the real financial benefits, but also healthier employees. Healthier employee means happier employees, less sick leave days, and a better corporate culture. And that's
And there's
better for everyone.
also, certain generations of our workforce that care passionately about these initiatives. And if you can improve their employee experience by helping them feel good about the time that they've spent at the office, that is also very meaningful. And it really does help with your employee retention.
Absolutely. And I believe even for new employees, a lot of Gen Zers, a lot of millennials, when they want to join a firm now, a lot of them are asking about these things. They want to, okay, what are you doing with respect to sustainability? What are you doing with respect to ESG? What are you doing in terms of composting and recycling? People care about these issues. And as you said, existing employees as well. This is becoming more and more in the sort of the fore of the employee mindset.
Absolutely.
Well, Aaron, I think we've, again, I don't know. Thank you very, very much for sharing your expertise, sharing your insights with us. And thank you also to our attendees at the time that you're going to be watching this fireside chat. We hope you found this fireside chat very useful and you walk away with some very practical information and tips about how you can stay compliant with the existing regulations, with the new regulations that are coming in the over the horizon. And also why it makes really just very simple business sense for organizations to be paying attention to the items that we spoke about today. We will continue to give updates on a regular basis of when there are significant updates that we can share with you. Thank you again, and bye-bye. Have a good day.
Hi, everybody. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the GRF on the Co podcast. Visit our website at grfcpa.com for more information about the services we provide, the industries we serve, or to request a quote.